the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. And my guest this week is Sergeant Marco Martinez, U.S. Marine Corps, who has written a new book called Hardcore, From Gangster to Marine Hero. He is the recipient of the Navy Cross for Valor in Iraq, the first Hispanic-American in the war to receive that honor, which is the second highest award a U.S. Marine can get, second only to the Medal of Honor. He joins us, and we're very happy to have you with us. This book of yours is remarkable to me in many respects. In the first place, you obviously tell it like it is, or like it was, and I guess still is. And then there's the story of your own personal redemption, I suppose, is the best way to put it. Is that right?
Sure is.
Well, tell me about what you had to be redeemed from. I know you led a life out in the Southwest of that was pretty hardcore in itself in another way.
Yeah, you know, around seventh grade, I fell into gang life, which is not uncommon during the early 90s for, you know, minorities in America as far as living in type of bigger cities. And, you know, I engaged in all kinds of things that I should not have been in that young. And finally, after years, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th grade, you know, after doing, you know, various things, you know, getting into fights, being shot at, you know, and jumping people, beating people up, all kinds of things like that, I finally found my way through all that when I saw a Marine recruiter walking through my high school hallway. And right then, my life changed.
Well, you had a loving mother. Your father was career Army man, Army Ranger. I would have thought that those would have been influences that would have taken you the other direction when you were young.
You know, initially they did. Growing up, all I ever wanted to do was be in the military. You know, I grew up on Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas. You know, growing up on a military base, all you see is, you know, these tough-looking guys in uniform, you know, tactical vehicles all the time, and, you know, that really influences you. But what happened to me is I have triplet sisters, and that's a handful in itself for two parents on an E6's pay grade to raise, including myself. So a lot of the focus was put towards my sisters, and I was kind of not really, you know, sidestepped, but I was kind of left to my own devices. And when a young, impressionable youth is left to his own devices, it's easy for someone else to influence him, and that's really what happened to me.
Well, you said you had been previously influenced by these tough guys on the base, but what was it in the hood that you saw some people you thought were just as tough?
Yeah, you know, it was when I was 5 years old, my father got orders to Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And at that point, you know, I went through my elementary years, you know, still an innocent boy and things like that. But something about the gang culture just totally took me out of my element as far as being interested in the military. And the whole way along when I was doing all this stuff, I still was interested in the military, but I just kind of lost my path, as a lot of youngsters do. You know, I was, you know, trying to find who I was, trying to see, you know, what I wanted to be. And for some reason, that particular lifestyle just, I gravitated towards it just because I'm a person who seeks action and adventure. And believe me, that lifestyle never lacked that. And I think that's what really attracted me initially. But in the end result is I found out that it was really not worth anything, and it's counterproductive to even be part or affiliated with that type of stuff.
Well, as you say somewhere that in the book, that your first 17 years of your life was a waste of oxygen, and you probably would have ended up dead pretty early if you'd stayed in that path.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I've been shot at numerous times before I even joined, before I was even in Iraq, you know, from fellow Americans. I was being shot at by, you know, rival gang members, guys that didn't like me, and vice versa. And if I would have died for something as stupid as misinterpreted glances, dying over colors, dying over rivalries, which no one even knows how they started, that would have been a waste of life. And that's why I say for the first 17 years of my life, I was a waste of oxygen, because I really was. I was devoid of any purpose that was going to help America succeed in anything it's trying to do. And basically, I walked around eating, sleeping, and breathing air that, you know, someone who was doing something purposeful could have used. And like I said, you know, dying for something as dumb or as stupid as misinterpreted glances or colors, that's unacceptable. That's not a way to go out. If you're going to die doing something, it should be in service of your country.
Tell me about the day this Marine Corps sergeant walked into your school.
I was hanging out with some friends in this main hallway of the entrance of the school, just kind of this grand hallway. And I was talking with some friends, and I think we were talking about skipping the class after lunch. And this Marine recruiter walks by in his Deltas. His Deltas were inspection ready. You know, I saw his ribbons. I saw he was a staff sergeant. You know, I saw his blood stripes. His shoes were really shined up. You know, he just looked and carried himself in a manner that I've never seen anyone carry himself before. And that was the first time I've actually seen a Marine in person. I mean, I've seen him on the commercials. You know, you got that commercial where that Marine slaps that sword right next to his face at the position of attention. But when I saw him, he just carried himself in a way that I have never seen anyone else carry themselves. And right then I was intrigued by, you know, the way the Marines were acting or what the Marines had to offer. So when I saw him, I think I was the only person to actually notice him, because everyone else was kind of into their own thing. But when I saw him, it kind of just snapped me out of the world I was in and said, hey, this guy's going places and he knows what he's doing. So the following week, I went and visited the Marine Corps recruiter.
You had a few difficulties getting past him, though, to get in, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I had when I was in ninth grade, I had a tattoo tattooed on my lower back, which is it's gang-related tattoo. And he had told me when he found out that I was, you know, serious about doing this, because a lot of guys go into the recruiter's office and then they get cold feet. But I was serious about doing this, and he knew that. So he had told me that your gang tattoo is going to be a problem when you go to the MEPS, which is a military entrance processing facility, which is where you do your physical and you go to the Marine liaison, who's going to screen you out further than the recruiter does. So he had told me that it's going to be a problem. When I got to MEPS, it was a problem. The gunnery sergeant there really did not want to let me into the Marine Corps based off the fact that I had a gang-related tattoo. He had a police gang identification book for tattoos, and he told me right here, if you have this tattoo, it says that you're a hardcore gang member. And indeed I was, but I pleaded with him and told him what I was trying to accomplish and what I was trying to do, and I guess he must have felt that I was genuine and he'll let me pass to the next phase. And then when I got to boot camp again, I had to, you know, kind of just give him my plight of what was happening. And then, thankfully, that particular staff sergeant let me go also. And since I've left that life, I've had nothing to do with it since then. I truly wanted to, you know, correct the wrongs that I've done and make my parents proud, finally, and I did that by joining the Marine Corps.
In fact, some people were rejected for the very reasons that you've just cited, and or other kinds of tattoos as well, right?
Anytime you go into the military, they want to know every single thing about you. They want to see any markings, scars, anything like that. So tattoos, they screen those out right away, because a lot of the times tattoos have means that other people may not know about. For instance, when we were in boot camp, there was a guy who had a tattoo on his forearm, which is not a big deal, you know, to begin with. But upon closer inspection, this guy was a white supremacist, and you could see that there was a swastika inside of this. He had a tattoo of a skull on his forearm. And upon closer inspection, it was the staff NCO was able to see that he had a swastika tattooed inside that skull, so he got kicked out, because the Marine Corps does not tolerate that type of thing at all.
Well, there are a whole lot of things they don't tolerate, and you relate in vivid detail what it was like going through boot camp, for example, and there were times, I am sure, by your own account, when you were not quite certain you were going to be able to hack it.
This is true. When you're in boot camp, you're exposed to things that you're normally not exposed to. You're put in situations where you're very uncomfortable, as far as, you know, physically or maybe mentally, because the Marine Corps is going to come at you from a psychological standpoint, and they're going to come at you from a physical standpoint. And either those two combined or one of those is going to make you break, and that's what they want to do. They want to break you down and then build you back up into a hard person. And they subject you to things that, you know, you wouldn't dream of being subjected to. For instance, having to get dressed in about 30 seconds, you know, things like that. And it just progresses from there. It gets worse and worse and worse. And then you start to do things like, you know, having been worked out for about, you know, 45 minutes straight, and then all of a sudden you're working out for 3 hours straight and then 4 hours straight, you know, things that people didn't think that they had inside of them that they could do. But they do this on purpose because they know that mutual suffering equals bonding and brotherhood, and it makes the platoon act in unison, and they become tighter upon completion of this mutual suffering. So in hindsight, at the time, it may seem like it's not doing anything to make anyone tighter, but it really is. You just don't see it until it's over.
You had some advantage in that, thanks to this recruiting sergeant, you had already gotten yourself in a whole lot better physical shape and had learned a lot from manuals and books he gave you about military protocol.
Right. My recruiter was, I want to say, one of the better recruiters that I've ever heard of. I've only experienced, you know, I've only enlisted once, so, you know, I only know one recruiter. But, you know, recruiters come in different levels of competence, and his particular level of competence was very high. On a scale of 1 to 10, I would rate him a 13. He was really interested in me succeeding in the Marine Corps. He didn't care about, yeah, he got me in, which is what the recruiter wants to do. They want to get, you know, people in. But he cared about my success afterwards. A lot of recruiters sometimes will get a kid to come in, and then once he's already shipped off to boot camp, he views it as it's no longer his problem. It's the drill instructors and so on and so forth.
Marco, we're going to have to take a break right here, and then we'll come back and continue on that line. We're talking to Navy Cross recipient Sergeant Marco Martinez, U.S. Marine Corps. We'll be right back after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with Sergeant Marco Martinez, United States Marine Corps, about his experiences in the Marines and how he changed his life from being a gang member to a Marine hero. He is the recipient of the Navy Cross, the second highest honor a Marine can receive, second only to the Medal of Honor for heroism under fire. He has a new book out called Hardcore, From Gangster to Marine Hero, and he's joining us this week. And Sergeant Martinez, we're talking about building and bonding and unity and cohesion and all of those things. And by the time you got through with the boot camp, you already sensed that with the group of people you had been with for a long time, right?
Yeah, I sure did.
And how did it manifest itself? I mean, at the same time, you were brothers, but you always were fighting among yourselves.
Right, you know, any time a group of individuals live together, there's bound to be fights and disagreements and things like that. And boot camp is no different. And as a matter of fact, you're actually introduced to people that you would have never met in your entire life. You're going to meet people from states that you'll maybe never visit. You got guys that come from different economic backgrounds, from the very poor to the very rich, the very educated to the very uneducated. And you're all thrown together, so there's bound to be disagreements. You know, fights do erupt. But it's not anything, you know, hatred or malice or anything like that. You know, that's just the way that you, in the Marine Corps at least, well, at least we did. I can't speak for the entire Marine Corps or people, but we took our aggressions by fighting. And after the fight ended, you know, you give each other a handshake and a hug, and you were that much closer because, you know, you were just fighting out your differences. It wasn't anything for hate or anything like that. It was just, okay, I don't agree with what you said to me earlier. Let's go ahead and strap it out a little bit. Once it's over, hey, let's have a handshake and a hug, and, you know, that's it. It's over with. It's squashed. And that's really an old-school way to approaching that particular problem, and it worked out for my platoon.
Well, your platoon wanted nothing more when the training was completed than to get into the action, as you put it in the book, to get some. That could have had any number of meanings, obviously, but in this case it was to get into the fight. And you sort of experienced a good deal of frustration there for a while because you couldn't get in, right?
Right. During September 11th, my unit was stationed in Okinawa, Japan. And I remember that day vividly. I was on mess duty, which required me to wake about 4 o'clock in the morning to make it to the mess hall in time to prepare for the influx of Marines that would come that morning for breakfast. And my roommate had waken me up, and he had told me this Cessna or some planes had flown into the World Trade Center. And I had originally thought that maybe it was some kind of error on a Cessna pilot's part, but when he told me that there were, you know, huge airliners, I knew something was wrong. I walked over to the rec room, and just about the whole company was standing in this recreation room watching the events unfold that we all saw that day, that tragic day on September 11th. And since we were in Japan, our AO was all the Pacific countries, like Japan, Philippines, Indonesia, all those places like that, South Korea. And initially we were told we were going to go to Afghanistan, and we were all ecstatic to go over there because we were going to exact our revenge on this terrorist group that, you know, did this hell to America. And just like a pit bull on a leash, you can only go so far. We were told that our AO was in the Pacific Theater, so we weren't allowed to leave. And it just so happened that 1st Marines, 1-1, happened to be in the area, and they were sent to Afghanistan before us, and we were held back. And our frustration was that we were so close, yet so far. For a Marine combat unit to be a rifle company and know that there is a war going on and you're not part of it, it starts to make that unit feel inadequate and insufficient, and because you know that other Marines in the same kind of position are actually out there doing their job, because the infantry trains for what they might do, not for what they will do. And when there's an opportunity for you to actually apply your skills that you've been training for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and then you're not able to do it, you kind of, morale is going to start to plummet a little bit. And that happened in my unit. We were disappointed that we were not able to go to Afghanistan and participate in that theater of war.
Well, you must have had some idea that it was going to be broader than Afghanistan before it was over.
Yeah, as soon as we found out about 1-1 going to Afghanistan and then the influx of Marines and soldiers going into Afghanistan, we knew that since this was a terrorist group, not a particular country that was attacking us, we knew that at that point that we were going to actually go after all terrorists across the world. So it was only a matter of time until we found another country that was harboring terrorism, which happened to be Iraq.
So in the meantime, while you're waiting for that, you come back home. Actually, you went down to Australia for some leave at one point, I believe.
Yeah, we went on float. We were at sea for 45 days. We hit various Liberty ports. We did some real-world humanitarian operations in East Timor. You know, we did all the typical Liberty ports, Philippines, you know, Indonesia, all kinds of places like that. And then we went back to Japan and then deployed back to the United States of America. And at that point, my senior Marines that were in charge of me got out of the Marine Corps shortly after that. Now we were on top, and we received our new guys, and then we started a build-up that ended up preparing for deployment to Iraq.
Well, we're going to start with the deployment to Iraq when we come back after taking another short break. We're talking with Navy Cross recipient Sergeant Marco Martinez of the United States Marine Corps about his experiences in Iraq and his valor and the award he received for it. And we'll be back right after these messages.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Vietnam area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest place.
Beat here for Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with Sergeant Marco Martinez, United States Marine Corps, once a gang member who became the first Hispanic American in the War on Terror to receive the Navy Cross, the second highest award a U.S. Marine can receive. He's the author of the book Hardcore, just out, called Hardcore from Gangster to Marine Hero. You were just about getting ready to deploy to Iraq when we paused for the last break. What were your first impressions when you arrived?
Well, before we arrived in country, we got a dump of new guys, and I just want to cover this because I think it's important.
All right.
Most of the new guys that we got were older than us because they had joined because of September 11th, and a lot of guys were from the East Coast, and they had their own reasons for joining the Marine Corps, and a lot of it had to do with September 11th. So we did a year-long buildup with our new guys and then deployed to Iraq. When we first got to the Middle East, we arrived in Kuwait, and we stayed in Kuwait for about 45 days. We were out in the middle of nowhere. We were living in fighting holes, and we were out there practicing and doing field operations that were of non-combat nature just to prepare and acclimatize for our eventual invasion of Iraq. So we had 45 days to go out there in the desert, and I'll tell you this right now, it was an experience that I'll never forget. I've never experienced such heat and humidity. I've never experienced, you know, being pelted and basically sandblasted by sand every time there was a windstorm. And it was just a whole different environment which we were unused to really operating in, other than, you know, training at 29 Palms, California for 1 month out of the year. So it was a real eye-opener to see what kind of environment that we would be fighting in.
What about the terrorist attack and the ambush that happened at the Battle of El Tarmiya? What are your memories of that? They're obviously very vivid because you are so sharp in your detail about exactly what happened.
Right, on April 12, 2003, RTC-5, which is Regimental Combat Team 5, had set up shop in Baghdad University, which is near downtown Baghdad. And we had set up our command post there to regroup and figure out what our next mission was going to be. Our particular mission at that point in time was to fight irregular forces, that being the Fedayeen fighters. And if you can remember the Fedayeen fighters, they were the worst of the Saddam loyalists. They were the guys who wore the all-white ninja suits.
Right.
And we had some credible intelligence that said that there was a force of a company size massing about 12 miles north of Baghdad, which is a suburb of Etramiya, is a Baghdad, or is a suburb of Baghdad. And so we went over there in our tracks. Just we rolled as a single company. And my platoon was pegged out to do the reconnaissance of that particular town. And initially on our roll up there, as soon as you got into the area, you just felt this weird electricity in the air, like something was not right. It's just something like your sixth sense went off, and you just felt that something was not right. Upon doing the reconnaissance, all hell broke loose. RPGs went off. Sniper fire started happening. Guys started popping out of windows. And basically, that was it right there. That was the ambush. One of our tracks was taken out. Initially, we took two wounded right off the bat. A squad of my company had taken, or a squad of my platoon had taken a defensive position in the house that was nearby the track. A four-hour firefight ensued, house-to-house fighting, terrorists everywhere. I mean, no matter where you were at, where you were stepping, there was someone shooting at you. There was groups of people shooting at you, and it was just pure hell. Once we got far enough into the town to actually create a stronghold, my squad leader was wounded. He nearly had his leg blown off by a grenade. At that point, I took charge of my squad, which was my new acquired squad, and I devised a plan on site under fire that we had to clear out this house that was directed to the left of us, which we were receiving fire from. Initially, we had to leave my squad leader outside because he could not walk, so I left the fire team behind to take care of our wounded squad leader, and with my fire team, four guys, we cleared out this three-story house. It had about 15 terrorists inside. And amazing, and I can't believe we cleared out without taking any wounded, but we did. Our skills were superior to these guys. And we finally created a stronghold inside the house. And then we started receiving fire from all kinds of other different directions. So the rule of thumb is never slow down your offense. So we went to the next house and to the next house. And then finally we got to this one house where most of the guys were inside of. Upon entry of this courtyard, we got pinned down in the front yard, and I and some other Marines hid behind these palm trees and returned fire. There was a guy to the left of me who took a bullet on the left side of his torso, and he became paralyzed, and he collapsed like a sack of bricks. And at that point, I had realized that if I didn't do something at that particular point in time, that they were going to shoot him while he laid on the ground. Now, it was difficult to expose ourselves because there was so much fire going on that if you were to expose yourself to the fire, you'd probably get shot just like he had. And at that point in time, I glanced to my right, and I noticed an RPG laying on the ground from a terrorist that we had killed earlier. Now, I picked up the RPG not knowing how to shoot it. I've never seen one in person. I've never picked one up. I've only seen them in pictures and in movies. So I picked it up, and in about 30 seconds, I learned how to shoot it, you know, real time. Under fire, I learned how to shoot the weapon. Initially, I had two malfunctions with that particular RPG, and then finally, I figured out exactly what was wrong with it, and I shot it into the house. Once I made that shot, we were able to evacuate the two wounded Marines that we had on my squad. Then the terrorists resumed their attack. And as soon as they resumed their attack, you know, I said something has to be done. So I charged that house by myself, firing my weapon until all my ammo was gone. And by the grace of God, I was not hit by any rounds. And when I got close enough, I prepped a hand grenade, threw it in the window. The grenade detonated, killing some of the terrorists inside of that room. Once the grenade detonated, I went into the house and cleared out the house of the remaining terrorists. And that gave us a tactical advantage to continue on our assault. But without me doing that, we would have been pinned down there for who knows how long. Most of our ammo was gone. We had depleted ammunition supply. Most of us were down to six magazines, which is not very many magazines to have in a fight that you don't know how long it's going to last. So once we got that tactical position and we had the stronghold, we were able to link up with the rest of my platoon, which had a firmer stronghold down the road a little bit. And after we linked up with them, about 30 minutes later, we indexed out of there. We pulled out of there because at that point in time, there was no tactical reason to stay in that town. We had eliminated the town of about, what was it, 75 terrorists.
Hmm. Well, it's no wonder that you are allowed to wear the Navy Cross after all of that. Let's turn to a couple of other things. You are extremely critical of the media in this book, and I understand why. Maybe some people don't, but what was your particular gripe?
My particular gripe was that the liberal media has really made the troops into villains, and they often give false reports of what's really going on the ground. We had an embedded reporter with my platoon and my company, but she would oftentimes try to befriend Marines, and then once you become friendly with someone, you might open up a little bit more than you would with a stranger, and then as soon as she got the story out, it was something negative. When, in fact, nothing negative was said or done, but she twisted the story around to where it was negative. And I think this happens to a lot of units that have reporters with them, or just reporters that are just out there, you know, by themselves, not attached. And they give false reports of what's happening on the ground, what we're doing, how people feel, what's going on, and all that kind of stuff like that. And it really just paints a bad picture for us out there, because if the American public knew what was really going on, you know, maybe perception of the war would be different. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the Iraq war has gone 100% smooth and bad things don't happen. Bad things do happen. This is war. War is terrible. But the liberal media has really, I think, really falsified some stories and twisted things around to where people's perceptions of the war, have taken a change towards somewhere where they would not initially think of the war being as bad as it is, because of these stories that are being put out. And that's my major gripe. Just tell it the way it is. Don't twist words around. If it's a good story, don't try to twist it around. If someone has something hopeful to say, don't put something hopeful with something bad. You know, don't just put the story the way it is. To my knowledge, that's the way journalists are supposed to operate. They're supposed to be truthful, and they're supposed to not twist stories around. And I've felt and I've seen what reporters have done over there in Iraq. They really, you know, villainized the troops and really have made Iraq seem worse than it really is. And to me, that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Since you've been back, and you have undoubtedly watched some news coverage on television, has what you have seen being shown here close to what you experienced over there?
As far as the combat, yes, you know, the urbanized combat is brutal, and, you know, there's no getting away from that. But as far as, you know, trying to villainize Marines for, you know, doing their job, you know, when they're doing raids, you know, things like that, and then something bad happens, collateral damage is always going to happen. Now, I have never met a person, Marine Corps, Army, Navy, Air Force, anybody who's been in Iraq who intentionally wants to create collateral damage. But these reporters would have you believe that they in fact do want to create collateral damage, and this is just not true. I think that because of what the media has shown in Iraq, the military has reacted by retraining their troops to second-guess themselves in combat, and this has created casualties and death. When you have a Marine who's going inside a house and clearing a house out where there's known terrorists, a lot of the times there's civilians inside that same house. And the terrorists exploit this, and they know that Marine is going to be, you know, held up at one room because there's, you know, maybe a woman and her child in there. But in the next room, there might be terrorists. And now you have Marines going in there and second-guessing, you know, what they're supposed to do in there because they're scared to death that if they make the wrong move that, you know, they're going to end up in the brig, they're going to end up in Leavenworth for, you know, 200-plus years because of a decision they made during combat. And a lot of the times people don't realize that when you're in combat, every split second counts. And it's easy to play, you know, Monday quarterback from here in your house watching TV when you're not in the heat of the moment. And I think a lot of people fail to realize that all these decisions are made on a split second basis during combat. And people need to realize that during combat, every split second counts. So not every single time is the outcome going to be, you know, what that troop wanted it to be. But I don't think any troop really acts in malice. And I think that since the media has really portrayed the Marines and the Army and everyone else as going in there and just, you know, killing everyone, this is not true. And I think that's what the media has done to kind of alleviate that kind of perception of us. I think the military has really trained their Marines and their soldiers now to be more cautious of what's happening while they're inside the house, which it should be, but it's causing them to second-guess themselves during combat, and that's, I think, unsatisfactory.
We've got about 2 minutes left here. You write at one point, you go infantry for one reason, to defend our great nation. It is not the foolishness of youth or a lust for violence like anti-military nitwits would have you believe. That's your philosophy, pretty much?
Yeah, you know, it's this country is the greatest country on the planet. This country has given so much to everyone that's come here. I don't think that anyone can complain about our living standards. There's no way you can complain about that. I've been to third world countries where I've seen the way people live. Believe me, some of the poorest people here in America are living 1,000 times better than some of these people in India and other places like that. And, you know, you just go to the infantry for one reason, like I said, you know, because you love America so much, to die in service for a country if need be. And after joining the Marine Corps, I really did feel that. And even before I joined the Marine Corps, I really did feel that. And it's something that I think that every infantryman inside him, deep inside, feels. There's so much that this country has offered so many people from people that have come from abroad. You know, we have a lot of immigration here to America. And why? Because it's the greatest country on the planet. People don't come here just because, you know, for no reason. They come here for a reason. Everyone comes here because this is the greatest country in the world, and everyone knows that.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Sergeant, and thank you for those words, as well as thank you for your service, and thank you for coming on to give your story to our listeners, and we appreciate it very much. And we've been talking this week with Sergeant Marco Martinez, United States Marines, the recipient of the Navy Cross for Valor in Iraq. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.